Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is David Hargett. I represent Mr. Bradley in his appeal from Petersburg. This case has had a few twists and turns procedurally, but of course we are here on the limited issue of whether or not the argument that the evidence was insufficient to prove intent to distribute was preserved for appellate review. I think that this case is simply one of those situations where the parties, the litigants and the court, fairly well understood what the issues were and addressed them. And so I understand that it certainly would not be recommended to simply say there's an issue here, whether it's possession or possession with intent to distribute. That's not something that we would advocate as a good, clean argument. By drawing the court's attention to that distinction between possession and possession with intent to distribute, and then the prosecution, during their argument and response, addresses particular factors that should weigh in the court's consideration for whether there is intent to distribute, and then the court's finding that there was intent to distribute by referencing several of those factors, although slightly different factors, but the same ideas, that means that the court had the opportunity to rule intelligently on the issue, that the court was aware of what the issue was, and the court did so rule. So, again, I would not recommend it. I would say that if counsel's simple argument of there's an issue here of whether there's possession or possession with intent to distribute, and then the court doesn't address it at all, then we potentially have a problem here. But in this particular case, when you go, the prosecution's response is there's a lot of money found here. There is the packaging issue. There is the testimony from an expert regarding whether it was possession, whether it's consistent, the amount of drugs is consistent with personal use. And the judge picks up on those same factors, articulates those same factors, and then both denies the motion to strike and finds him guilty at the same time, that the issue has been preserved.
Is that the only place in the record that we can find any argument on this issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. That has to be enough, or it's either that or nothing.
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
All right. I wasn't missing something.
That's the top of page 37. There's several lines, or bottom of 36, top of 37.
Right.
37, 38, yes.
That's it, right?
That's correct.
You surely
would. That's the only place I could find.
You wouldn't call that best practices, would you?
Would not recommend that. But, you know, in the defense attorney's, to his credit, there were a lot of issues here. I mean, it wasn't just possession versus possession with intent to distribute was not the biggest issue. I think that the firearm was, and that was addressed thoroughly. And nobody caught the problem. And, of course, the marijuana distribution was reduced to simple possession, but nobody eventually caught the sentencing problem associated with that. So there's a lot going on here. And I'd also say that this case might have a different argument, or I might even be in a worse position if this had been a jury trial. Because I think that in that case, you can't just assume that people know what's going on or that we're aware of what the issues are because it's a jury. And so in this particular instance, the motion to strike had a dual purpose. I mean, as he says at the very few lines after that, just almost as an afterthought, right before the prosecution speaks on page 37 of the appendix, he says, which is also my closing statement. So you do have this dual purpose of the motion to strike / closing argument, which you do oftentimes get in a bench trial setting. Of course, you would not have that in a jury trial setting. But yes, I mean, and that's kind of the point here, is that even though it wasn't said very well and no details were provided, the issues that we raised on appeal all stem from those factors that are articulated by the prosecution and then are also articulated by the court in making its ruling.
But isn't the problem that the Court of Appeals had that they were not articulated by defense counsel?
You can read into that, yes.
Because they say making one specific argument on an issue does not preserve a separate legal point on the same issue for review. That's what the Court of Appeals said. It almost seems to me as if they're saying the argument concerning the motion to strike for possession with intent to distribute has been preserved, but the only argument made concerning that was that he really didn't possess it. And so we're not going to hear any other arguments you have now concerning why there was insufficient evidence on the possession with intent to distribute charge, because that was the only argument you made at trial.
Well, he made others at trial, but specifically about that, you can interpret his statement as being only that. I understand that. But once the prosecution responds point by point and the court rules point by point on the factors of intent to distribute, not mere possession, I don't think anybody really, I don't even think there was much of an addressing the whether the jeans were unisex and that sort of argument that was made also.
Right, but it almost seems like to me the defense held his hat on, hung his hat on, they weren't his pants. So all this other stuff is irrelevant, doesn't matter. And only, my only argument as to why he's not guilty of possession with intent to distribute is because they're not his pants. We don't dispute that there were scales there. We don't dispute that, a bunch of money in the pockets. We don't dispute all those other things that are indicia of intent to distribute. But they weren't his pants. So, we went. And I thought that the Court of Appeals was just saying, well, that was your argument. And so on appeal, that's what we're going to analyze.
Well, I would say that there are really two arguments. I mean, he made that argument. But I also think that he brought to the court's attention the argument that there wasn't sufficient evidence of intent to distribute. And I make that point not lightly. I mean, I understand that it's better to say it actually during the motion to strike. But throughout the course of the trial, defense counsel did challenge the intent to distribute element or the factors that would associate it with that.
Where do you think he did that?
Well,
I thought that's why we were having you point to page 37 as to where he made his argument.
Well, he didn't make the argument. He challenged the Commonwealth's evidence on that point, is my point.
Okay.
So, and keep in mind, I mean, this is not something that's foreign to a trial judge who has been on the bench for any period of time, that this issue is a major issue. And obviously, if you have a whole grocery bag versus of cocaine or what have you, there's not going to be an issue there. But any time it's a small amount, small quantity of drugs, it's a real issue because we have a huge disparity between the punishment associated with the possession versus possession and distribute. So the defense attorney, when the expert, actually the police officer, who qualifies as an expert to testify about whether it's consistent with personal use, he challenges his own law on that. And because there is a very small difference amount between the amount that a person would normally buy and the amount that he had on him. So there was not a big gap at all. And defense counsel brought that to the court's attention through the cross-examination, I would say. So I think that that's why prosecution and the court picked up on the argument that was being made. Now, whether it was said sufficiently or not is, of course, the issue. And I think when you look at the contemporaneous objection rule, like has been the discussion this afternoon, the language refers to make the argument with reasonable certainty. And I think that perhaps one of the struggles that we have here is determining whether that's objectively reasonable or subjectively reasonable. I mean, if the court is aware of the argument, how much more does counsel really need to say? If the court specifically addresses the argument, do you then need to say, well, I disagree with you, Judge? I mean, I don't think you do. So, whether you look at back, standing back from it and say, well, objectively, that wasn't a reasonably certain enough argument. Well, subjectively, I think that if you understood that that's what everybody knew, whether the words were articulated, whether the word objection was used, whether there was magic words or not, if the court knew what was going on, then doesn't what the court ruled prove that the purpose of the rule has been satisfied, and that's to bring it to the court's attention so that the court can rule intelligently, because certainly the court was attentive to that issue, and the court intelligently ruled, although we disagree with the final analysis, but the court did make an intelligent ruling as to that particular issue.
The court wasn't just ruling on the motion to strike, really. It was deciding the case, and it necessarily had to find, regardless of what arguments had been made, really, that there was evidence beyond a reasonable doubt each of the elements of the charged offenses. Let me finish. So, I mean, I guess it ruled, but was it ruling in response to an argument? Was it ruling because that's what the court had to do at that point? But then, furthermore, when I go back and look at this one sentence that's in this record, if you read what was argued before and what's argued, more importantly, immediately after he makes that sentence, he goes immediately into, again, I didn't put these pants on. I never possessed this because those weren't my pants. I didn't put them on. Isn't the Court of Appeals right that all he ever really said to the court was, I didn't possess this?
Well, I agree that it's a very weak argument. But I think that he brought it to the court's attention. And I reiterate that with the fact that he made the distinction. The question is whether there's possession or possession with intent to distribute, or possession at all. I mean, he kind of threw that in there at the end.
And then he's
which
arguing,
is the argument about the pants.
Yes, that's his next line.
Right. But that doesn't mean that that's the only argument included in that sentence. I mean, you could look at it that way. I understand. But I would suggest that you do not need to look at it that way, because we know what happened next. We know that the prosecution addressed the issue, and we know the court addressed those issues. As far as the dual purpose argument that I brought up, and that's why I pointed it out, because I don't want the court to believe that the only thing the court was doing was responding to the motion to strike. I think we would have a better argument there if that were the case. But it's a dual purpose. But as far as did the court have to do that in order to find him guilty, the answer is yes. The court did have to find that the evidence was sufficient beyond reasonable doubt as to each and every element of the offense. But the court is not required to articulate that. And so when it's a dual purpose situation, you really have to assume that it addresses both unless there's a specific reason why it doesn't. In other words, if the court said, well, I'm not going to address your argument on that because of this, that, or the other thing, then maybe we don't go that far. But if we know it's a dual-purpose argument, and the response is, from the court specifically, that, well, I think that there was evidence of distribution because of the packaging, because of the cash that was found, and because of the expert's testimony about it being inconsistent with personal use, then the court is aware of the issue, and again, doesn't need to say that. So we have to assume that it's for both purposes. It's responding to the motion to strike as well as ruling on the case. And if there are no other questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee, the Commonwealth of Virginia. The Court of Appeals did not err in this case in applying Rule 5A18 because the arguments that the defendant presented at trial are distinct from the arguments that he presented on appeal. And what he said during that second motion to strike, I think taken in context, is nothing more than I would submit a challenge to possession at all. He said, on the cocaine, the DNA evidence. I'm not sure if that's the cocaine that was submitted. Of course, that has to do with whether it's the same cocaine that was found. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but let's assume for the case that it's not. The question here is whether it's possession or possession with intent to distribute or possession at all. And then he explains what he means immediately afterwards by saying, what is interesting is that when he gets up and puts on his pants, he doesn't put on those pants. And there's no evidence that those pants would even fit him or that they were even men's pants. At best, it's unisex. And earlier in the trial, there had been an entire argument, which I included in the appendix, an argument, a discussion with the officer about whose pants they were and whether he had admitted it was his cocaine in the pants or if it could have been the woman who was in the bed, if they could have been her pants, whether they were men's pants or women's pants, whether they submitted them for DNA. And, of course, the only reason for that discussion was a challenge to the possession. And I think it's interesting, this dual-purpose argument, had he said nothing at all, but the court had just gone through and said, these are the elements, and I find him guilty, that certainly wouldn't have been sufficient. It wouldn't have stated with reasonable certainty any objection. In the same way that if the prosecutor goes through and says, well, these are the elements we've proven, that doesn't save him from having to state his objection with reasonable certainty, because that's what the rule requires. And furthermore, there were arguments made here on appeal in the Court of Appeals that were never addressed specifically by the trial court. I'm talking about in his brief, he says the most important argument that he's making has to do with the officer's testimony about what an average person would have the amount that an average person would have, and whether that's sufficient, that whether that language is sufficient to show intent to distribute. The judge made no comment about average person, and in fact was denied any opportunity to even address that argument because it was never made at trial. And so the fact that you only say the question is whether it's possession with intent or possession at all does not in no way alerts the trial court to specific arguments, to any specific challenge that you may later bring up with regard to that issue. And, of course, this court has a lot of jurisprudence about possession with intent and the myriad ways that it can be proven. And so there are many challenges that he could have raised that by making one certainly wouldn't preserve another. We could have challenged the expert's testimony. We could have challenged the amount. We could have challenged the packaging. There are just so many different things that could have been raised, and that is insufficient to preserve any of those arguments. And unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
It's certainly not a textbook argument, and again, I would not recommend it. However, I think the issue here is what was understood doesn't come out on black and white words printed on paper. So if the court understood those to be the issues, then I think that the rationale behind the contemporaneous objection rule has been met. In other words, it served its purpose. He's made the argument. Now, I would say one thing, that this gets very tricky, because when an attorney makes an insufficiency evidence argument and during a motion to strike, they will focus on certain elements, and here the element is intent to distribute. And oftentimes on appeal, we will call additional facts from the transcript to point out why the evidence is insufficient. It seems to me that it's almost being suggested here that everything that is said at the trial court, everything that we say on appeal must have been said at the trial court or we can't say it. And I simply disagree with that. If that were the case, we wouldn't really need appellate lawyers. We would just read the transcripts and those would be the arguments and we would be done. So when you're pointing out and you're making specific arguments about an element, the question then becomes, well, how well do you have to do that at the trial level to then make those arguments later on an appeal? For instance, the prosecution pointed out that there were scales. There was an issue, the defense attorney didn't argue anything about the scales. There's no evidence that the scales were in any way linked to this particular defendant. So it's a good argument, but it wasn't made. So let's say he made all the other arguments, and then on appeal, we argue that all those other factors show that the evidence is sufficient, but we also argue that the scales weren't linked to the defendant in any way. Are we precluded from making that argument? I don't think so. So, I put it in terms of laying the finger upon the issue. He did with that statement that he made in the transcript. It might not have been the best argument he could have made for sure, and it may be interpreted differently by other people. I understand that. But the fact that the prosecution responded to it and the court ruled on it shows that the objection was made sufficiently enough to preserve it for a week.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Court will be adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All right.